From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
They came and placed me under arrest. Violation of the segregation law of the city and state of Alabama and transportation. I didn't think I was violating any. I felt that I was not being treated right and that I had a right to retain the seat that I had taken as a passenger on the bus.
Rosa Parks, mother of the modern civil rights movement, has died.
Well, I wasn't afraid. I don't know why I wasn't, but I didn't feel afraid. I had decided that I would have to know once and for all what rights I had as a human being and a citizen, even in Montgomery, Alabama.
Today, Rosa Parks, in her own words, we go back to one of her earliest preserved interviews and the latest on the CIA leak case.
This morning we learned in the New York Times that Louis Libby first learned about the Valerie Plame name from the vice president himself, Dick Cheney. So this raises a new possibility in terms of indictments. Certainly there will be indictments for Louis Libby and Karl Rove and perhaps for Stephen Hadley, but this raises the question of whether or not Dick Cheney will be named as an unindicted co-conspirator.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Civil rights pioneer Rosa Parks has died at the age of 92. It was 50 years ago this December that she refused to relinquish her seat to a white man aboard a city bus in Montgomery, Alabama. Rosa Parks was arrested and convicted of violating the state's segregation laws. Her act of resistance led to a 13-month boycott of the Montgomery bus system that would spark the civil rights movement. The boycott would also help transform a 26-year-old preacher named Martin Luther King Jr. to national prominence. In 1958, King wrote, quote, "No one can understand the action of Mrs. Parks unless he realizes that eventually the cup of endurance runs over and the human personality cries out, 'I can take it no longer.'" Parks had been involved in the right for freedom since the 1940s. She was active in the NAACP, helped raise money to defend the Scottsboro rape case, and attended trainings at the Highlander Folk School of Tennessee. The Reverend Jesse Jackson said yesterday she sat down in order that we might stand up. Paradoxically, her imprisonment opened the doors for our long journey to freedom. Henry Louis Gates Jr. called her the Harriet Tubman of our time. After he was freed from jail, Nelson Mandela recalled how Rosa Parks had inspired him and others in the South African struggle against apartheid. We'll have more on Rosa Parks in her own words in a few minutes. This update on the CIA leak case. The New York Times is reporting today it was Vice President Dick Cheney who first informed his chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby, that Valerie Plame was an undercover CIA operative. Lawyers involved in the case say the two discussed Plame on June 12, 2003, weeks before she was outed in the press. Plame is the wife of former U.S. Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who's accused the White House of outing his wife because he'd publicly criticized the Iraq War. Cheney reportedly learned of Plame from then-CIA Director George Tenet. This development raises new questions about whether Libby misled the grand jury. Previous reports indicate Libby told investigators he learned of Plame's identity from members of the press. Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald is expected to issue indictments this week. In news from Iraq, the Palestine and Sheraton hotels in Baghdad came under attack on Monday. The Washington Post described it as one of the most complex and coordinated insurgent attacks of the war. Estimates on the number killed range from 6 to 20. The Palestine Hotel houses many foreign journalists. The attack began when an explosives-filled car blasted the concrete wall surrounding the hotel. Minutes later, a cement truck carrying a massive bomb tried to ram the hotel where the wall had once stood. The truck detonated in an enormous fireball. Iraq's national security advisor said this was a clear attempt to take control of the hotel and seize Western journalists as hostages. No journalists were killed, but three staff members from Associated Press Television News were wounded. The New York Times described the incident as the first major attack against a foreign civilian target since the United Nations and Red Cross were hit. Meanwhile, the Guardian newspaper reports two staff members from the Moroccan Foreign Ministry are believed to have been kidnapped in Iraq. Earlier today, Iraqi officials announced Iraq's draft constitution has been approved. In the Shiite and Kurdish areas, the constitution was passed by a near-unanimous vote. However, two Sunni-dominated provinces defeated it by overwhelming margins. In Anbar, 97% of voters rejected the constitution. And the U.S. death toll in Iraq is creeping closer to 2,000. The military has announced a Marine died in Ramadi on Sunday, bringing the death toll to 197. Anti-war activists have organized over 300 protests to take place across the country on the day after the U.S. announces the 2,000th U.S. soldier has been killed. On Monday, Cindy Sheehan announced she and other peace activists will begin holding a daily vigil each night this week outside the White House. Residents in southern Florida, Cuba, and Mexico are all facing massive cleanups following the devastating Hurricane Wilma. In Florida, at least 6 people have died and 6 million are without power. In Cuba, parts of Havana flooded after a seawall broke Monday. In Cancun, 500,000 residents have lost nearly everything. The New York Times is reporting Vice President Dick Cheney and CIA Director Porter Goss met with Senator John McCain last week to urge him to back exempting CIA officers from a proposed Senate ban on torture. 3 weeks ago, the Senate voted 90-9 to ban the use of cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment of any detainee held by the government. Cheney reportedly said the CIA needs to be exempt because the president needs maximum flexibility in fighting the so-called war on terror. Tom Alinowski of Human Rights Watch responded to the news by saying, quote, they are explicitly saying for the first time that the intelligence community should have the ability to treat prisoners inhumanely. Meanwhile, the American Civil Liberties Union announced Monday at least 21 detainees have died in U.S. custody in Iraq and Afghanistan. The ACLU reached that number based on released Pentagon documents. British MP George Galloway is back in the news. U.S. Senator Norm Coleman accused Galloway Monday of giving false testimony when he testified before the Senate earlier this year about Iraq's oil for food program. Coleman, a Republican from Minnesota, claims Galloway personally solicited and was granted oil allocations and payments from Saddam Hussein's government. Galloway is a leading critic of the war. He rejected the charges and has volunteered to return to Washington to testify. In other news from the Middle East, Israeli troops have shot dead Islamic Jihad's top commander in the West Bank, Loi Asadi, the most senior Palestinian to be killed by Israeli troops since the start of the 8-month-old ceasefire. Islamic Jihad vowed revenge and suggested the killing could mark an end to the ceasefire. Palestinians fired a series of rockets into Israel. Overnight, Israel bombed the Gaza towns of Beit Hanun and Rafah. Meanwhile, the International Middle East envoy, James Wolfensohn, has accused Israel of behaving as if it has not withdrawn from the Gaza Strip by blocking its borders and failing to fulfill commitments to allow the movement of Palestinians and goods. In media news, the alternative weekly newspaper publisher New Times announced Monday it is merging with the parent company of The Village Voice. The new company will operate 17 weekly publications across the country, including the LA Weekly, the San Francisco Weekly, the Dallas Observer, the Miami New Times, and The Village Voice.
Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on, let me stand. take my hand.
Mahalia Jackson, Take My Hand, Precious Lord, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Rosa Parks is dead at the age of 92. The civil rights pioneer died late last night. It was 50 years ago this December. She refused to relinquish her seat to a white man aboard a city bus in Montgomery, Alabama. She was arrested and convicted of violating the state's segregation laws. Her act of resistance led to a 13-month boycott of the Montgomery bus system that would spark the civil rights movement. It would inspire freedom struggles abroad, including in South Africa. The bus boycott would also help transform a 26-year-old preacher named Martin Luther King Jr. to national prominence. Rosa Parks' arrest came just months after the lynching of Emmett Till. At the time of her arrest, Parks was a 43-year-old seamstress, a seasoned civil rights activist. Since the 40s, she'd been active in the NAACP, helped raise money to defend the Scottsboro rape case, and attended trainings at the Highlander Folk School of Tennessee. After the successful bus boycott, Parks would continue to take part in the civil rights movement in this country. She marched in Selma, Alabama, took part in the 1963 March on Washington. After moving to Detroit, she worked for Congressmember John Conyers. In a few minutes, we'll speak with the congressman about Rosa Parks. But first, we go back to 1956, in the midst of the Montgomery bus boycott. In April of that year, Rosa Parks spoke with Pacifica station KPFA about her decision just 4 months earlier not to move to the back of the bus. The interview comes from the Pacifica Radio Archives.
I left work on my way home December 1st, 1955, about 6 o'clock in the afternoon. I boarded the bus downtown in Montgomery on Coates Square. As the bus proceeded out of town, on the third stop, the white passengers had filled the front of the bus. When I got on the bus, the rear was filled with colored passengers, and they were beginning to stand. The seat I occupied was the first of the seats where the Negro passengers take as they on this route. The driver noted that the front of the bus was filled with white passengers, and there would be of two or three men standing. He looked back and asked that the seat where I had taken, along with three other persons, one in the seat with me and two across the aisle, was seated. He demanded the seat that we were occupying. The other passengers very reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused to do so. I want to make very certain that it is understood that I had not taken a seat in the white section, as has been reported in many cases. An article came out in the newspaper on Friday morning about the Negro woman overlooked segregation. She was seated in the front seat, the white section of the bus, and refused to take a seat in the rear of the bus. That was the first newspaper account. The seat where I occupied, we were in the custom of taking this seat on the way home, even though at times on this same bus route, we occupied the same seat with whites standing if their space had been taken up, the seats had been taken up. I was very much surprised that the driver at this point demanded that I remove myself from the seat. The driver said that if I refused to leave the seat, he would have to call the police, and I told him, just call the police. He then called the officers of the law. They came and placed me under arrest, violation of the segregation law of the city and state of Alabama and transportation. I didn't think I was violating any. I felt that I was not being treated right, then that I had a right to retain the seat that I had taken as a passenger on the bus. The time had just come when I had been pushed as far as I could stand to be pushed, I suppose. They placed me under arrest, and I wasn't afraid. I don't know why I wasn't, but I didn't feel afraid. I had decided that I would have to know once and for all what rights I had as a human being and a citizen, even in Montgomery, Alabama. And I was bailed out shortly after the arrest. The trial was held December 5th on the next Monday, and the protest began from that day, and it is still continuing. And so the case was appealed. From the time of the arrest on Thursday night and Friday and Saturday and Sunday, the word had gotten around over Montgomery of my arrest because of this incident. There were telephone calls from those who knew about it to others. The ministers were very much interested in it, and we had our meetings in the churches. And being the minority, we felt that nothing could be gained by violence or threats or a belligerent attitude. We believed that more could be accomplished through the nonviolent passive resistance. And people just began to decide that they wouldn't ride the bus on the day of my trial, which was Monday, December 5th. And Monday morning, when the buses were out on their regular run, they remained empty, and people were walking or getting rides in cars with people who would pick them up as best they could. On Monday night, the mass meeting at the Hope Street Baptist Church had been called, and there were many thousand people there. They kept coming, and some people never did get in the church. There were so many. I was not the only person who had been mistreated and humiliated. I have been refused entrance on the buses because I would not pay my fare at the front and go around to the rear door to enter. That was the custom if the bus was crowded up to the point where the white passengers would start occupying. I hadn't thought that I would be the person to do this. It hadn't occurred to me. Others had gone through the same experience, some even worse experience than mine, and they all felt that the time had come that they should decide that we would have to stop supporting the bus company until we were given better service. And the first day of remaining off the bus had been so successful, it was organized then that we wouldn't ride the bus until our request had been granted.
Rosa Parks from an April 1956 recording from the Pacifica Radio Archives at pacificaradioarchives.org. When we come back, we'll hear from Congressmember John Conyers. Rosa Parks worked with him for more than a decade. And then the latest news on the CIA leak case. The New York Times is reporting today it was Vice President Dick Cheney who first told Scooter Libby that Valerie Plame was an undercover CIA operative. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Stay with us.
I'm gonna let it shine, oh, this little light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, this little light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. I'm gonna let it shine, oh, this little light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine, this little light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. Oh, everywhere I go, Lord, I'm gonna let it shine. Oh, everywhere I go, Lord, I'm gonna let it shine, everywhere I go, I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. I feel the light of freedom. I'm gonna let it shine. Oh, I've got the light of freedom. I'm gonna let it shine.
the light of freedom. I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine, let it shine.
Jesus gave me the light.
I'm gonna let it shine. Oh, Jesus gave me the light. I'm gonna let it shine. Jesus gave me the light.
The Freedom Singers, This Little Light of Mine, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 375 stations around the country, on Pacifica, NPR, and low-power FM stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. And we are podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Civil rights pioneer Rosa Parks has died at the age of 92. It was 50 years ago this December that she refused to give up her seat to a white man aboard a city bus in Montgomery, Alabama. She was arrested and convicted of violating the state's segregation laws. Her act of resistance led to a 13-month boycott of the Montgomery bus system that would spark the modern-day civil rights movement. Rosa Parks later lived in Detroit for more than half her life. Earlier this morning, we reached Congressmember John Conyers in Detroit. He worked with Rosa Parks for more than a decade. I asked him to talk about Rosa Parks' life.
Sure, I can tell you about Rosa Parks. I began meeting her many years ago in the civil rights movement. And I had met her before she came to Detroit because I was invited down south to different places with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And I was happy to be in her company. I had no idea at the time that she would end up in Detroit. It so happened that there was some family here, and when she couldn't get a job, she was a pariah in Alabama, Montgomery. She couldn't find work, so she decided to relocate. And she and her husband, Raymond, decided to come to Detroit. And so it so happened that she was also coming to my campaign meetings as I was a candidate for Congress at that time. And to our great delight, she was very quiet, but she would come and she would help us. And I said that when I won this seat, the first thing I would do is offer her a position on my staff if she would accept. And to my honor and delight, she did accept. And we were happy to have her in my original staff.
What are the adjectives you would use to describe Rosa Parks?
She was a humble person. That's the first term I think that would come to mind. Also, that she was very resolute. She happened to be a religious person as well. And she took her Bible and the teachings quite seriously. But she also believed in constitutional government. And she believed that a civil rights movement was going to be necessary. And I think that combination of considerations led her to one day coming home from work decide that she would not obey the segregation laws of Alabama and would face arrests, incarceration, trial, imprisonment as a result of it. And she had deep religious convictions, but she also believed very strongly that the constitutional requirement of equality and freedom was something that had to be initiated and continued. And she earned her title as Mother of the Civil Rights Movement. There wasn't any question about that, because out of the bus boycott came this young new minister from Boston named Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., 26 years old. And that really not only sparked the 380-day bus boycott that then led to a federal suit that struck down desegregation, not only in the buses, but it was interpreted to extend to all forms of desegregation, of which there was plenty, and it wasn't all in the South. There was desegregation in the North as well. So it was out of that turbulence, and it was a very violent era. I just returned from Birmingham, Alabama, and I was taken by the school in which Reverend Shuttlesworth was beaten. He was protesting segregation, and he was severely beaten. He had to go to the hospital. Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, who incidentally is one of the few last original members of the Dr. King organization with Ralph Abernathy and Andrew Young, that came together to put the new civil rights movement on the map and to really get it moving in all the directions that it eventually took, was right there. And you're sort of stunned when you go by a place in a city that's now so relatively quiet and say, good night, that's where that incident took place. I can't help but marvel at the fact that Rosa Parks essentially had a saint-like quality. And I use that term advisedly, because she never raised her voice. She was not an emotional person in terms of expressing anger or rage or vindictiveness, but she was resolute. And this was an unusual set of circumstances for a person who, as the movement went on and the successes built up, she became more and more recognized as the person who had, without probably intending to, initiated a resurrection of the civil rights movement. And it seems to me that her passing is probably the end of an era, because Rosa Parks for so long was celebrated in many instances all over the world. She was constantly traveling, receiving awards. She received the Congressional Medal of Honor. She was honored in Washington. And as a matter of fact, one of my responsibilities this week is to meet with our federal officials, both in the executive branch and in the Congress, to determine what is the fitting national response to the life and legacy of someone who dared to struggle to give her life, to chart an unknown path, which eventually made America much stronger, brought about the civil rights laws that were so desperately needed, and gave many of us hope that through a people's power, we would be able to make this constitutional mandate of equality and justice something that was real and tangible in a country that whose original coming together had agreed that the vile institution of enslavement would continue even as we formed a new independent democratic nation.
We're talking to Congressmember John Conyers, who worked with Rosa Parks for more than a decade. We're speaking to him in Detroit, where Rosa Parks lived more than half of her life. Congressmember Conyers, would there be a state funeral for Rosa Parks?
I think that's one of the options that are on the table. We'll be meeting to consider how this should be done, and that's an important consideration. There are a number of things that we can do, and I want to make sure that her homegoing is properly observed, not just in the cities in which she lived, but by our national government, indeed, because she was certainly a national citizen. She was a citizen of her country who held up her beliefs and fought for them in a way that reflected great courage on everyone that joined her.
What else could the government do? What are you considering?
We're looking at a wide number of options. There could always be erected a statue in her behalf. There could be naming of federal installations or buildings after her. There has already started before her passing some that wanted a day in her honor, a holiday for her. Those are among the other things that might be considered.
A national holiday.
Yes, ma'am.
Like Martin Luther King Day, Rosa Parks Day.
Mm-hmm. Yep. There are people that I'm sure have started it already because I was approached about that a while back.
Congressmember Conyers, it's often said Rosa Parks was simply a tired seamstress who sat down. But the fact is, she was a longtime activist. It's a story that she tells. Do you think it's significant that story be told?
Yes, it's true that she had been one of the active leaders in the struggle against segregation. And of course, she was well-known and well-respected. But the fact was that she had not planned this, and that it was because of her activity and her belief system, to me, that something may have told her on that day, at that moment, on that bus, that she was going to do what she did.
Congressmember John Conyers, speaking to us from Detroit, worked with Rosa Parks for more than a decade. Rosa Parks died yesterday at her home at the age of 92. We'll have more on her life in the days to come. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we turn now to a major development in the CIA leak case. The New York Times is reporting today that Vice President Dick Cheney's chief of staff, Lewis Scooter Libby, first learned the identity of the CIA operative from his boss, Dick Cheney. Lawyers involved in the case say the two discussed the CIA operative, Valerie Plame, on June 12, 2003, weeks before her undercover status was outed in the press. Plame is the wife of former U.S. Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who's accused the White House of outing his wife because he had publicly criticized the Iraq War. Notes of the previously undisclosed conversation between Libby and Cheney also appear to run counter to Libby's testimony to a federal grand jury that he first learned about Plame from reporters. According to the New York Times, the notes do not show that Cheney knew the name of Wilson's wife, but they do show that Cheney did know and told Libby that she was employed by the CIA and that she may have helped arrange her husband's trip to Niger. The notes also indicate Cheney had gotten his information about Plame from George Tenet, the director of Central Intelligence, in response to questions from the vice president about Wilson. Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald is expected to decide whether to bring charges in the case by Friday when the term of the grand jury expires. Reports have indicated both Libby and President Bush's senior advisor, Karl Rove, face the possibility of indictment. At a cabinet meeting at the White House on Monday, President Bush said, quote, "This is a very serious investigation." While the case is focused on the outing of an undercover operative, it centers around the administration's justification for the invasion of Iraq, and the mainstream media is now focusing again on the faulty claims of weapons of mass destruction. In an article in the Los Angeles Times, Lawrence Wilkerson, Colin Powell's chief of staff at the State Department for 3 years, writes, quote, "Some of the most important decisions about U.S. national security, including vital decisions about post-war Iraq, were made by a secretive, little-known cabal. It was made up of a very small group of people led by Vice President Dick Cheney and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld." We're joined now by former CIA and State Department analyst Mel Goodman. He's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and director of the center's National Security Project. He's the author of the book Bush League Diplomacy, How the Neoconservatives Are Putting the World at Risk. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. Good to be with you.
It's good to have you with us. Well, can you respond to this latest revelation that it was the vice president who told Scooter Libby about Joseph Wilson's wife?
Well, my first reaction is, wow, this is big. From the first day, I was convinced that Dick Cheney was the center of this covert action to lead the country into war, because this is what this is about, the misuse and the secret use of intelligence. It's about that more than it is leaks and sources and even Valerie Plame's identity. It's about how we went to war. Dick Cheney, I thought, would obtain some kind of plausible denial because this was run like a CIA covert action. But now he's lost his denial if he was indeed the source of Valerie Plame's name to Louis Libby, who then went forward with Karl Rove to give this name to at least five or six journalists. And, of course, it was Robert Novak who did the administration's work for it. He was what some people would call the useful idiot who then ran the Valerie Plame name in his column. But this is now in the White House. And once, frankly, you had Louis Libby implicated, Louis Libby is just an apparatchik. As an old Soviet analyst, the Libby type is quite recognizable. And you knew that he had to have some sponsorship or endorsement, or he was galvanized in some way by, indeed, his patron. And, of course, his patron was Dick Cheney. The question is, to what degree was Karl Rove keeping the president witting of this? My guess is that the president was protected. And I think for the president to say that this is a serious charge is very important, because if you read the editorial pages of the New York Times today, the op-ed page, particularly Nicholas Kristof and John Tierney, they don't even know it's serious yet. And if you read the Washington Post op-ed pages, Richard Cohn and Jim Hoagland, they don't understand it's serious because they think it's about leaks and sources. It's about war. It's about lying to go to war. I cannot imagine what could be a more serious charge than misusing intelligence data and evidence to go to war. But this is what we're dealing with, and this is what Patrick Fitzgerald, who is the hero in all of this, understands. He knows it's more than leaks and sources. So what Patrick Fitzgerald has had to do is the work that should have been done by the Senate Intelligence Committee. This is what the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Pat Roberts from Kansas, should have been doing. To what degree was a forgery or a fabrication used in the case to go to war? And we know there was a forgery used in the president's State of the Union message in January 2003. The Senate wouldn't look at this. The Democratic Party wouldn't look at this evidence. The print media has dismissed it. But thank goodness for Patrick Fitzgerald, who's a tough, hard, independent prosecutor, special prosecutor, who to me behaves like a junkyard dog, which is what you want from someone at this level. And I think he's going to get to the bottom of this. I'm very confident of that. So there will be indictments, I am sure. I think these are short odds on Louis Libby and Karl Rove, no doubt about that. I think there's a possibility that Stephen Hadley, as a member of the White House Iraqi group, could also be indicted. And I would not be surprised, even though this would be a long shot, but if I'm playing with house money, Amy, and I'll make it your house money, I would say that Dick Cheney could be an unindicted co-conspirator, because I think he was at the center of all of this.
We're talking to Mel Goodman, former CIA and State Department analyst, speaking to us from Washington, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, director of the Center's National Security Project, author of Bush League Diplomacy. We'll come back with him in a minute. Sweet honey in the rock, we shall not be moved. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our conversation with Mel Goodman, former CIA and State Department analyst, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, author of Bush League Diplomacy, How the Neoconservatives Are Putting the World at Risk. Mel Goodman, can you talk about the significance of the prosecutor, Fitzpatrick, talking about requesting the Niger documents. What is the significance of this?
Well, that is very significant because the Niger documents are really forgeries. They're fabrications. And what should have happened when you're dealing with a fabrication that gets into the White House, and indeed gets into the most important message that the president delivers to the country, the State of the Union message, there should have been a counterintelligence investigation. How did this fabrication take place? Who was responsible for it? How did it get to the CIA? How did the CIA transmit this to the White House? How, indeed, did it get into the president's message? And this never happened. Over the weekend, there was a very important UPI article by Martin Walker, a wonderful British journalist, who talked about Fitzgerald having access to an Italian parliamentary investigation. Apparently, this has been known by NATO intelligence sources. The Italians have investigated this document, and apparently they know something about the forgery. The fact that the United States has never had the counterintelligence investigation tells me that former agency people could be involved. And I say that because in the 1980s, under the CIA of Bill Casey and Bob Gates, there was serious misuse of intelligence to make the case that the Soviets were involved in the papal plot, the attempt to assassinate the Pope in 1981. I would not be surprised if this was the same kind of covert action in which you had black propaganda used to get the president, to allow the president to say something in the State of the Union that just indeed was not accurate. And I think the special prosecutor understands this. But again, why didn't the Senate Intelligence Committee look at this? Why didn't the news media ask the questions of who, what, why, when, how? None of this has been asked because of their obsession with leaks and sources, that they might lose a source, that Judith Miller had to go to jail. What has happened to freedom of the press? Nonsense. What has happened to the freedom of the press is that it's being allowed to atrophy because journalists won't do their job. So the special prosecutor is doing the job the Senate should have done, the media should have done, and the Democrats should have done. I think he's a hero.
Mel Goodman, former CIA and State Department analyst, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Can you talk, you mentioned the Iraq group. Talk about who exactly you're referring to and what that means.
Well, the Iraq group was put together in the White House in 2002, about the same time that Donald Rumsfeld set up a secret shop in the Defense Department called the Office of Special Plans. So what the Office of Special Plans did was to create the intelligence, sometimes out of whole cloth, that the CIA dismissed because it just was bad intelligence. So the Office of Special Plans would create this phony intelligence or bogus intelligence. They would pass it to the White House Iraq group, which was set up by Andy Card, who, was, of course, is the chief of staff to the president. Their job was to write materials for people such as Condi Rice and Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney to go to the public to talk about the mushroom cloud, to talk about nuclear reconstitution, to talk about the famous or infamous aluminum tubes that had nothing to do with nuclear weapons at all. Now, all of this was known to the White House Iraq group. It was known to Libby. It was known to Rove. It was known to Hadley, Stephen Hadley. That's why I think Hadley might be named in these indictments that should come down tomorrow and Friday. But I think, again, that Fitzgerald understands the misuse of policy and how we went to war. And he's investigated the White House Iraq group, which the Senate should have investigated. And presumably, he's looked at the Office of Special Plans under Douglas Feith, who is now gone, who created a lot of this phony intelligence. Again, lying to go to war. You know, what is worse than this? I cannot think of anything at the White House level, at the presidential level.
Who are David Wormser and John Hanna?
Well, David Wormser and John Hanna have been involved with Dick Cheney for the past 10 years. John Hanna was on Cheney's staff for a period of time. Wormser has gone back and forth between the White House, the Defense Department, the State Department. He's affiliated with John Bolton when Bolton was the Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and Disarmament. There's a possibility they could be named because I'm sure they were feeding a lot of this bogus intelligence to the press and to the White House Iraq group. And certainly these were part of Cheney's apparatchiks, the people who worked in the shadows, who worked in the background to get this story out to the public to allow people like Condi Rice to say over and over again that we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. And unfortunately, the public bought it, and the press bought it. Certainly the Washington Post editorial staff bought it, and the Congress bought it when they voted in October 2002. Dangerous stuff.
I wanted to play for you the chief of staff of Colin Powell when he was Secretary of State, Lawrence Wilkerson. Very controversial speech he gave that's rocking some of the inner circles. He just gave this speech a few days ago.
What I saw was a cabal between the Vice President of the United States, Richard Cheney, and the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, on critical issues that made decisions that the bureaucracy did not know were being made.
That was Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. Mel Goodman, former CIA analyst, your response.
Well, cabal happens to be the right word. This is about four or five people who took the government into their own hands, who didn't want to discuss policy at the table because they knew there were some differences within the State Department and within the CIA in the way we were going to war. They knew there were differences about the number of troops that would be needed, and that's why Paul Wolfowitz and others were so dismissive of professional military officers such as General Shinseki, who said it's an inadequate number of troops. But the question is not the number of troops. That's so many, you know, how many angels can dance on the head of the pin. It's about whether we should have gone to war or not. And of course, we should not have gone to war. This is an illegal and immoral war. And I think when Wilkerson is talking about a cabal and he's talking about a dysfunctional government, this is exactly what he was talking about. Let's give the CIA a little credit. They did write some analytical pieces that anticipated the kinds of chaos and discontinuity that we're now seeing in Iraq. The State Department had a policy group set up that talked about the post-Iraqi war situation, but Donald Rumsfeld, as Secretary of Defense, prohibited his people from attending any of these meetings. They didn't want that. And remember, even the phony national intelligence estimate that the CIA put together in October 2002, this wasn't asked for by the administration because they knew there were differences. The State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research had serious differences with the conclusions reached by the CIA, which were for the most part bogus, because there was a point at which the CIA gave up. They were tired of telling truth to power, so they essentially gave up. George Tenet said to the president, "Oh, that's a slam dunk, Mr. President. If you want phony intelligence, I can get it for you." And we know that Alan Foley was the CIA officer in charge of negotiating with Bob Josephs the language, the famous 16 words, or infamous 16 words, that appeared in the State of the Union speech in January 2003. And of course, the CIA wrote Colin Powell's speech to the United Nations on the 5th of February 2003 that had 28 allegations. Every one of those allegations was false. And we know that because of the work not only of Hans Blix and Mohammed al-Baradei, the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, but we know it now because George Tenet sent out David Kaye and Charles Dulfer to Iraq after the war was over, and they made it clear there was nothing out there, there was nothing to be found. They couldn't even find detritus from 15-year-old programs. So this is what we're talking about, and I wish Richard Cohn and Jim Hoagland and Nicholas Kristof and John Tierney would read all of the evidence before they worry about protecting leaks and sources. Don't worry. There will always be leaks and there will always be sources, but we have to get to the bottom of this, and this is what Patrick Fitzgerald is doing. All credit should go to him.
We're talking to former CIA and State Department official Mel Goodman. We're also joined by Nick Turse. Is the possibility that officials high up in the Bush administration face indictments this week? Want to take a look at other officials who were forced out or resigned because of the stances they took against policies of the administration. In an article posted on TomDispatch.com entitled Foreign Legion, writer Nick Turse compiled a list of these people and their reasons for leaving. Nick writes, there is, quote, a seemingly endless and ever-growing list of beleaguered administrators, managers, and career civil servants who quit their posts in protests or were defamed, threatened, fired, forced out, demoted, or driven to retire by Bush administration strong-arming. Often, this has been due to revulsion at the president's policies, from the invasion of Iraq and negotiations with North Korea to flattening of FEMA and the slashing of environmental standards, which these women and men found to be beyond the pale, he writes. Nick Turse is the associate editor of TomDispatch.com. And then I wanted to get Mel Goodman's response to this. Nick, can you go through the list?
Well, thanks so much for having me in, Amy. You know, basically, at TomDispatch.com, we put together a list of 42 individuals to start who, were either forced out or quit in protest. Yeah, and these are people from across the government. This is the full spectrum, from the intelligence agencies to the military, State Department, to the EPA and the Forest Service, just about every level of government.
You call them the Fallen Legion. Go through some of them.
Some of the best known, I'll start with Richard Clark, perhaps the best known of them. He was the president's chief advisor on terrorism on the National Security Council, but he became disillusioned at what he said was the, quote, terrible job of fighting terrorism exhibited by the Bush administration. And he ended up quitting in protest. There was Paul O'Neill, who was the Secretary of Treasury, but when he opposed the president's tax cuts, he was asked to resign. Flint Leverett, Ben Miller, and Hillary Mann were senior officials on the National Security Council. And they end up locking horns with Elliot Abrams, Bush's NSC advisor on Middle Eastern affairs. Basically, what they said was that the administration was going to renege on commitments to European and Arab partners, and they just couldn't live with that. So, they were basically given the choice to be fired or resign.
So they were forced out by a man who was convicted of perjury in the Reagan-Bush years.
Yes, that's right.
Elliot Abrams.
Yes. There were very principled career diplomats from the Foreign Service. Anne Wright, she resigned on the day that the U.S. launched the Iraq War. She wrote in her letter of resignation to Colin Powell that the administration's policies were making the world more dangerous and not safer place. John Brady Keesling, a career diplomat, he served four presidents over a 20-year span. And on the eve of the invasion of Iraq, he tendered his resignation and said that the policies that we're now asked to advance are incompatible not only with American values, but also with American interests.
You also mentioned Larry Lindsay. Some might remember him, the top economic advisor to Bush, who was ousted when he revealed to a newspaper that a war with Iraq could cost $200 billion. Haven't we passed that point now?
Yes, yes.
Mel Goodman, as you listen to this list, it goes on. John Brown, the veteran of the Foreign Service who served in London, Prague, Krakow, Kiev, Belgrade, resigned from his post. Rand Beers, National Security Council Senior Director for Combating Terrorism, resigned. He declined to comment, but one former intelligence official noted, hardly a surprise, we've sacrificed a war on terror for a war with Iraq. I don't blame Randy at all, he said. Anthony Zinni, a soldier and diplomat for 40 years, served 97 to 2000 as Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Central Command in the Middle East. The retired Marine Corps general was then called back to service by the Bush administration to assume one of the highest diplomatic posts. He said, in the lead up to the Iraq War and its later conduct, I saw at a minimum true dereliction, negligence, and responsibility at worst, lying, incompetence, and corruption. I leave you, Mel Goodman, with the last word on this fallen legion.
Well, the real hero on the list for me is Anne Wright, and I don't think many people in the country know who Anne Wright is. She's a former military officer and Foreign Service officer. She was in the airborne. She took all of the toughest diplomatic assignments. And when she left, she did write an important letter of resignation, but she has never gotten her day in court in terms of the press really making an attempt to understand who is Anne Wright and why did she leave and why would someone who really didn't have an axe to grind, other than the fact that she wanted to tell truth to power and that the Bush administration was misusing power. The sad thing about the list, and it's an important list, and this is good work to put it together, is the resignation that didn't take place, and that's Colin Powell. So you have, the great American story, and Colin Powell is that, but he's always going to have to live with the fact that he used the phony intelligence that the CIA prepared for him, and he had to know that some of this was really bogus, that he was really stretching a point. And he had John Negroponte, the UN ambassador, sitting behind him, along with George Tenet, while these lies were told to an international community, therefore jeopardizing American credibility.
Mel Goodman, Nick Terse, want to thank you both for being with us. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.